of a bullet. Patrick crossed his arms. "There's no print on the weapon?" he clarified. "There's an inconclusive print on the trigger, probably smudged when your suspect dropped it, but I can't say that for certain." Patrick nodded and pointed to Gun A. "This is the one he dropped when I drew down on him in the locker room, so presumably it's the last one he fired." Selma lifted a bullet with a pair of tweezers. "You're probably right. This was retrieved from Matthew Royston's brain," she said, "and the striations are consistent with a discharge from Gun A." The boy in the locker room, the one who'd been found with Josie Cormier, the only victim who'd been shot twice. "What about the bullet in the kid's stomach?" Patrick asked. Selma shook her head. "Went through clean. It could have been fired from either Gun A or Gun B, but we won't know until you bring me a slug." Patrick stared at the weapons. "He'd used Gun A all over the rest of the school. I can't imagine what made him switch to the other pistol." Selma glanced up at him. He noticed for the first time the dark circles under her eyes, the toll this overnight emergency had taken. "I can't imagine what made him use either of them in the first place." Meredith Vieira stared gravely into the camera, having perfected the demeanor for a national tragedy. "Details continue to accumulate in the case of the Sterling shootings," she said. "For more, we go to Ann Curry at the news desk. Ann?" The news anchor nodded. "Overnight, investigators have learned that four weapons were brought into Sterling High School, although only two were actually used by the shooter. In addition, there is evidence that Peter Houghton, the suspect in the shootings, was an ardent fan of a hardcore punk band called Death Wish, often posting on fan websites and downloading lyrics onto his personal computer. Lyrics that, in retrospect, have some people wondering what kids should and should not be listening to." The green screen behind her shoulder filled with text. "Black snow falling, stone corpse walking, bastards laughing, gonna blow them all away on my judgment day. Bastards don't see the bloody beast in me, the reaper rides for free, gonna blow them all away on my judgment day." The Death Wish song Judgment Day includes a frightening foreshadowing of an event that became all too real in Sterling, New Hampshire, yesterday morning, Curry said. Raven Napalm, lead singer for Death Wish, held a press conference late last night. The footage cut to a man with a black mohawk, gold eyeshadow, and five pierced hoops through his lower lip, standing in front of a group of microphones. "We live in a country where American kids are dying because we're sending them overseas to kill people for oil. But when one sad, distraught child who doesn't see the beauty in life goes and wrongly acts on his rage by shooting up a school, people start pointing a finger at heavy metal music. The problem isn't with rock lyrics. It's with the fabric of this society itself." Ann Curry's face filled the screen again. "We'll have more on the continuing coverage of the tragedy in Sterling as it unfolds. In national news, the Senate defeated the gun control bill last Wednesday, but Senator Roman Nelson suggests that it's not the last we've seen of that fight. He joins us today from South Dakota. Senator?" Peter didn't think he'd slept at all last night, but all the same, he didn't hear the correctional officer coming toward his cell. He startled at the sound of the metal door scraping open. "Here," the man said, and he tossed something at Peter. "Put it on." He knew that he was going to court today. Jordan McAfee had told him so. He assumed that this was a suit or something. Didn't people always get to wear a suit in court, even if they were coming straight from jail? It was supposed to make them sympathetic. He thought he'd seen that on TV. But it wasn't a suit. It was Kevlar, a bulletproof vest. In the holding cell beneath the courthouse, Jordan found his client lying on his back on the floor, an arm shielding his eyes. Peter was wearing a bulletproof vest, an unspoken nod to the fact that everyone packing the courtroom that morning wanted to kill him. "Good morning," Jordan said, and Peter sat up. "Or not," he murmured. Jordan didn't respond. He leaned a little closer to the bars. "Here's the plan. You've been charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder and 19 counts of attempted first-degree murder. I'm going to waive the readings of the complaints. We'll go over them individually some other time. Right now, we just have to go in there and enter not guilty, please. I don't want you to say a word. If you have any questions, you whisper them to me. You are, for all intents and purposes, mute for the next hour. Understand?" Peter stared at him. "Perfectly," he said, sullen. But Jordan was looking at his client's hands. They were shaking. From the log of items removed from the bedroom of Peter Houghton. Number 1. Dell laptop computer. Number 2. Gaming CDs. Doom 3. Grand Theft Auto. Vice City. Number 3. 3 posters from gun manufacturers. Number 4. Assorted lengths of pipe. Number 5. Books. The Catcher in the Rye, Salinger. On War, Clausewitz. Graphic novels by Frank Miller and Neil Gaiman. Number 6. DVD. Bowling for Columbine. Number 7. Yearbook from Sterling Middle School. Various faces circled in black marker. One circled face X'd out with words, "Let live," beneath picture. Girl identified in caption as Josie Cormier. The girl spoke so softly that the microphone, hanging on a boom over her head like a piñata, had trouble picking up the unraveled threads of her voice.
"Mrs. Edgar's classroom is right next to Mr. McCabe's, and sometimes we could hear them moving their chairs around or shouting out answers," she said. "But this time we heard screaming. Mrs. Edgar, she took her desk and shoved it up against the door and told us all to go to the far end of the classroom, near the windows, and sit on the floor. The gunshots, they sounded like popcorn. And then..."
She stopped and wiped her eyes.
"And then there wasn't any more screaming."
Diana Levin hadn't expected the gunman to look so young. Peter Houghton was shackled and chained, wearing his orange jumpsuit and bulletproof vest, but he still had the apple cheeks of a boy who hadn't come through the far side of puberty yet, and she would have bet money he didn't have to shave. The glasses, too, upset her. The defense would play that to the hilt, she was certain, claiming some myopia that would have made sharpshooting an impossibility. The 4 cameras that the district court judge had agreed on to represent the networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN, hummed to life like a barbershop quartet as soon as the defendant was led into the room. Since it had gotten so quiet in the room that you could hear the sound of your own doubts, Peter turned immediately toward them. Diana realized that his eyes weren't all that different from those of the cameras, dark, blind, empty behind the lenses. Jordan McAfee, a lawyer Diana didn't like very much on a personal level, but grudgingly admitted was damn good at his job, leaned toward his client the moment Peter reached the defense table. The bailiff stood.
"All rise," he bellowed. "The Honorable Charles Albert presiding."
Judge Albert hustled into the courtroom, his robes whispering.
"Be seated," he said.
"Peter Houghton," he began, turning to the defendant.
Jordan McAfee stood. "Your Honor, we waive the reading of the charges.
We'd like to enter not guilty pleas for all of them, and we request that a probable cause hearing be scheduled in 10 days. This wasn't a surprise to Diana. Why would Jordan want the whole world to hear his client being indicted on 10 separate counts of first-degree murder? The judge turned to her. Ms. Levin, the statute requires that a defendant charged with first-degree murder, multiple counts at that, be held without bail. I assume you have no problem with this. Diana hid a smile. Judge Albert, God bless him, had managed to slip in the charges anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The judge nodded. Well then, Mr. Houghton, you're remanded back into custody. The whole procedure had taken less than 5 minutes, and the public wouldn't be happy. They wanted blood. They wanted revenge. Diana watched Peter Houghton stumble between the hold of 2 sheriff's deputies and turn back to his lawyer one last time with a question on his lips that he didn't utter. Then the door closed behind him, and Diana gathered her briefcase and walked out of the courtroom to the cameras. She stood in front of a thrust of microphones. Peter Houghton was just arraigned on 10 counts of first-degree murder and 19 counts of attempted first-degree murder and various accompanying charges involving illegal possession of explosives and firearms in this recent tragedy. The rules of professional responsibility prevent us from commenting on the evidence at this point, but the community can rest assured that we are prosecuting this case vigorously, that we have been working around the clock with our investigators to make sure that the evidence is collected, preserved, and appropriately handled so that this unspeakable tragedy will not go unanswered. She opened her mouth to continue, but realized that there was another voice speaking, just across the hallway, and that reporters were defecting from her impromptu press conference to hear Jordan McAfee instead. He stood sober and penitent, his hands in the pockets of his trousers, as he stared right at Diana. I grieve with the community for its losses, and will represent my client to the fullest. Peter Houghton is a 17-year-old boy. He's very scared. And I ask you to please have respect for his family, and to remember that this is a matter to be determined in court. Jordan hesitated, ever the showman, and then made eye contact with the crowd. I ask you to remember that what you see is not always all it seems to be. Diana smirked. The reporters, and the people all over the world who would be listening to Jordan's careful speech, would hear his little salvo at the end and believe that he had some fabulous truth up his sleeve, something that would prove his client wasn't a monster. Diana, however, knew better. She could translate legalese, because she spoke it fluently. When an attorney spun mysterious rhetoric like that, it was because he had nothing else he could use to defend his client. At noon, the governor of New Hampshire held a press conference on the steps of the Capitol building in Concord. On his lapel, he was wearing a loop of maroon and white ribbon, the school colors of Sterling High, which had sprouted up at gas station cash registers and Walmart counters and were being sold for $1 each, the proceeds going to support the Sterling Victims Fund. One of his minions had driven 27 miles to get one, because the governor planned to throw his hat into the Democratic primary in 2008 and knew this was a perfect media moment during which he could portray compassion at its strongest. Yes, he felt for the citizens of Sterling, and especially those poor parents of the dead, but there was also a calculated part of him that knew a man who could shepherd a state through one of the most tragic school shooting incidents in America would be seen as a strong leader. Today, all of this country grieves with New Hampshire, he said. Today, all of us feel the pain that Sterling feels. They are all our children. He glanced up. I've been up to Sterling, and I've spoken to the investigators who are working hard, round the clock, to understand what happened yesterday. I've spent time with some of the families of the victims and at the hospital with the brave survivors. Part of our past and part of our future disappeared in this tragedy, the governor said, as he looked solemnly into the cameras. What we all need now is to focus on the future. It took Josie less than a morning to learn the magic words. When she wanted her mother to leave her alone, when she was sick of her mother watching her like a hawk, all she had to do was say that she needed a nap. Then her mother would back off, completely unaware of the fact that her whole face relaxed the minute Josie let her off the hook, and that only then could Josie recognize her. Upstairs in her room, Josie sat in the dark with her shades drawn and her hands folded in her lap. It was broad daylight, but you'd never know it. People had figured out all sorts of ways to make things seem different than they truly were. A room could be turned into an artificial night. Botox transformed people's faces into something they weren't. TiVo let you think you could freeze time, or at least reorder it to your own liking. An arraignment at a courthouse fit like a band-aid over a wound that really needed a tourniquet. Fumbling in the dark, Josie reached underneath the frame of her bed for the plastic bag she'd stashed, her supply of sleeping pills. She was no better than any of the other stupid people in this world who thought if they pretended hard enough, they could make it so. She had thought that death could be an answer, because she was too immature to realize it was the biggest question of all. Yesterday, she hadn't known what patterns blood could make when it sprayed on a whitewashed wall. She hadn't understood that life left a person's lungs first and their eyes last. She had pictured suicide as a final statement, a fuck you to the people who hadn't understood how hard it was for her to be the Josie they wanted her to be. She'd somehow thought that if she killed herself, she'd be able to watch everyone else's reaction, that she'd get the last laugh. Until yesterday, she hadn't really understood. Dead was dead. When you died, you didn't get to come back and see what you were missing. You didn't get to apologize. You didn't get a second chance. Death wasn't something you could control. In fact, it would always have the upper hand. She ripped the plastic bag open into her palm and stuffed 5 of the pills into her mouth. She walked into the bathroom and ran the tap, stuck her head close to the faucet until the pills were swimming in the fishbowl of her bulging cheeks. Swallow, she told herself. But instead, Josie fell in front of the toilet and spit the pills out. She emptied the rest of the pills, still clutched in her fist. She flushed before she could think twice. Her mother came upstairs because she heard the sobbing. It had seeped through the grout of the tile and the soffits and the plaster that made up the ceiling downstairs. It would, in fact, become as much of this household as the bricks and the mortar, although neither of the women realized it yet. Josie's mother burst into the bedroom and sank down beside her daughter in the attached bathroom.
"What can I do, baby?"
she whispered, running her hands up and down Josie's shoulders and back as if the answer were a visible tattoo instead of a scar on the heart. Yvette Harvey sat on a couch holding her daughter's 8th grade graduation photo, taken 2 years, 6 months, and 4 days before she died. Caitlin's hair had grown out, but you could still see the easy, lopsided smile, the moon face that was part and parcel of Down syndrome. What would have happened if she hadn't chosen to mainstream Caitlin in middle school? If she'd sent her to a school for kids who had disabilities? Were those kids any less angry, less likely to have bred a killer? The producer from the Oprah Winfrey Show handed back the stack of photographs that Yvette had given her.
She hadn't known, before today, that there were levels of tragedy, that even if the Oprah show called you to ask you to tell your sad story, they would want to make sure it was sad enough before they let you speak on camera. Yvette hadn't planned to show her pain on television. In fact, her husband was so dead set against it, he refused to be here when the producer came to call. But she was determined. She had been listening to the news, and now she had something to say.
"Caitlin had a beautiful smile," the producer said gently.
"She does," Yvette replied, then shook her head.
"Did." "Did she know Peter Houghton?"
"No, they weren't in the same grade. They wouldn't have had classes together. Caitlin's were in the learning center." She pushed her thumb into the edge of the silver portrait frame until it hurt. "All of these people who are going around saying that Peter Houghton had no friends, that Peter Houghton was teased, that's not true," she said. "My daughter had no friends. My daughter was teased every single day. My daughter was the one who felt like she was on the fringe, because she was. Peter Houghton wasn't a misfit, like everyone wants to make him out to be. Peter Houghton was just evil."
Yvette looked down at the glass covering Caitlin's portrait.
"The grief counselor from the police department told me Caitlin died first," she said. "She wanted me to know that Katie didn't know what was going on, that she didn't suffer."
"That must have been some consolation," the producer offered.
"It was, until we all started talking to each other and realized that the grief counselor had told the same thing to every one of us with a dead child."
Yvette glanced up, tears in her eyes.
"The thing is, they couldn't all have been first."
In the days after the shooting, the families of the victims were showered with donations. Money, casseroles, babysitting services, sympathy. Caitlin Harvey's father woke up one morning after a light, last springtime snow to find that his driveway had already been shoveled by a Samaritan. Courtney Ignacio's family became the beneficiaries of their local church, whose members signed up to provide food or cleaning services on a different day of the week, a rotating schedule that would take them through June. John Eberhard's mother was presented with a handicap-accessible van, courtesy of Sterling Ford, to help her son adapt to life as a paraplegic. Everyone wounded at Sterling High received a letter from the President of the United States, crisp White House stationery, commending them on their bravery. The media, at first a wave as unwelcome as a tsunami, became something ordinary on the streets of Sterling. After days of watching their high-heeled black boots sink into the soft mud of a New England march, they visited the local farmway and bought Merrill clogs and muck boots. They stopped asking the front desk at the Sterling Inn why their cell phones didn't work and instead congregated in the parking lot of the mobile station, the point of highest elevation in town where they could get a minimal signal. They hovered in front of the police station and the courthouse and the local coffee shop, waiting for any crumb of information they could call their own. Every day in Sterling, there was a different funeral. Matthew Royston's memorial service was held in a church that wasn't large enough to hold the grief of its mourners. Classmates and parents and family friends packed into the pews, stood along the walls, spilled out the doors. A contingent of kids from Sterling High had come dressed in green T-shirts with the number 19 on the front, the same one that had graced Matt's hockey jersey. Josie and her mother were sitting somewhere in the back, but that didn't keep Josie from feeling that everyone was staring at her. She wasn't sure if that was because they all knew she was Matt's girlfriend or because they could see right through her. "Blessed are those who mourn," the pastor read,
for they will be comforted.
Josie shivered. Was she mourning?
Did mourning feel like a hole in the middle of you that got wider and wider every time you tried to plug it up? Or was she incapable of mourning because that meant remembering, which she couldn't do?
Her mother leaned closer. We can leave. You just say the word.
It was hard enough not having a clue who she was, but here, in the afterword, she couldn't seem to recognize anyone else either. People who had ignored her for her whole life suddenly knew her by name. Everyone's eyes got soft at the edges when they looked at her. And her mother was the most foreign of all, like one of those corporate addicts who has a near-death experience and becomes a tree-hugger. Josie had expected to have to fight her mother in order to attend Matt's funeral, but to Josie's surprise, her mother had suggested it. The stupid shrink Josie had to see now, probably for the rest of her life, kept talking about closure. Closure, apparently, meant that she was supposed to realize that losing normal was something you got over, like losing a soccer game or a favorite t-shirt. Closure also meant that her mother had morphed into a crazy, overcompensating, emotive machine, one who kept asking her if she needed anything. How many cups of herbal tea could a person drink without liquefying? And trying to act like an ordinary mother, or at least what she imagined an ordinary mother to be. If you really want me to feel better, Josie felt like saying, go back to work. Then they could pretend it was business as usual, and, after all, her mother was the one who'd taught Josie how to pretend in the first place. In the front of the church was a coffin. Josie knew it wasn't open. Rumors had flown about that. It was hard to imagine that Matt was inside that lacquered black box, that he wasn't breathing, that his blood had been drained out and his veins were pumped full of chemicals instead.
Friends, as we gather here to remember Matthew Carlton Royston, we are beneath the protective shelter of God's healing love, the pastor said. We are free to pour out our grief, release our anger, face our emptiness, and know that God cares.
Last year, in ancient world history, they had learned about how the Egyptians prepared their dead. Matt, who studied only when Josie forced him to do it, had been truly fascinated. The way the brain was sucked out through the nose, the possessions that went into a tomb with a pharaoh, the pets that were buried beside him. Josie had been reading the chapter in the textbook out loud, her head cradled on Matt's lap. He'd stopped her by putting his hand on her forehead.
When I go, he said, I'm going to take you with me.
The pastor looked out over the congregation.
The death of a loved one can shake us to our very foundations. When the person is so young and so full of potential and skill, the feelings of grief and loss can be even more overwhelming. At times such as this, we turn to our friends and family for a support, for a shoulder to cry on, and for someone to walk that road of pain and anguish with us. We cannot have Matt back, but we can rest easy knowing that he's found the peace in death he was denied here on earth.
Matt didn't go to church. His parents did, and they tried to make him go, but Josie knew he hated it. He thought it was a waste of a Sunday, and that if God was at all worthy of hanging around with, he'd probably be out riding around with the top down on his Jeep or playing pickup pond hockey instead of sitting in a stuffy building doing responsive reading. The pastor moved aside, and Matt's father stood up. Josie knew him, of course. He cracked the worst jokes, silly puns that were never funny. He had played hockey at UVM until he blew out his knee, and he'd had high hopes for Matt. But overnight, he'd turned hunch-shouldered and sullen, like a husk that used to contain the whole of him. He stood up and talked about the first time he'd taken Matt out to skate, how he'd started out pulling him along on the end of a hockey stick and realized, not much later, that Matt wasn't holding on. In the front row, Matt's mother began crying, loud, noisy sobs, the kind that splattered against the walls of the church like paint. Before Josie realized what she was doing, she'd gotten to her feet. "Josie," her mother whispered, fierce, beside her. In that instant, a flicker of the mother she was accustomed to, the one who would never make a spectacle of herself. Josie was shaking so hard that her feet didn't seem to touch the ground, not as she stepped into the aisle in the black dress she had borrowed from her mother, not as she moved toward Matt's coffin, magnetically drawn to a pole. She could feel Matt's father's eyes on her, could hear the whispers of the congregation. She reached the casket, polished to such a gleam that she could see her own face reflected back at her. An imposter.
"Josie,"
Mr. Royston said, coming down from the podium to embrace her.
"You all right?"
Josie's throat closed like a rosebud. How could this man, whose son was dead, be asking her that? She felt herself dissolving, and wondered if you could turn into a ghost without dying, if that part of it was only a technicality.
"Did you want to say something?"
Mr. Royston offered.
"About Matt?"
Before she knew what was happening, Matt's father had led her up to the podium. She was vaguely aware of her mother, who had gotten out of her seat in the pew and was edging her way down toward the front of the church. To do what? Spirit her away? Stop her from making another mistake? Josie stared out at a landscape of faces she recognized and didn't really know at all. She loved him, they were all thinking. She was with him when he died. Her breath caught like a moth in the cage of her lungs.
But what would she say? The truth?
Josie felt her lips twist, her face crumple. She started to sob, so hard that the wooden floorboards of the church bowed and creaked, so hard that even in that sealed casket, Josie was sure Matt could hear her.
"I'm sorry,"
she choked out, to him, to Mr. Royston, to anyone who would listen.
"Oh, God, I'm so sorry."
She didn't notice her mother climbing the steps to the podium, wrapping an arm around Josie, leading her behind the altar to a little vestibule used by the organist. She didn't protest when her mother handed her Kleenex and rubbed her back. She didn't even mind when her mother tucked her hair back behind her ears, the way she used to when Josie was so small she could barely remember the gesture.
"Everyone must think I'm an idiot,"
Josie said.
"No, they think you miss Matt."
Her mother hesitated.
"I know you believe this was your fault."
Josie's heart was pounding so hard it moved the thin chiffon fabric of the dress.
"Sweetheart,"
her mother said,
"you couldn't have saved him."
Josie reached for another tissue and pretended that her mother understood. Maximum security meant Peter didn't have a roommate. He didn't get recreation time. His food was brought to him 3 times a day in his cell. His reading material was restricted by the correctional officers, and because the staff believed he might be suicidal, his room consisted of a toilet and a bench. No sheets, no mattress, nothing that might be fashioned into a means of checking out of this world. There were 415 cinder blocks on the back wall of his cell. He had counted. 2. Since then, he'd taken the time to stare right at the camera that was watching him. Peter wondered who was at the other end of that camera. He pictured a bunch of COs clustered around a crummy TV monitor, poking each other and cracking up when Peter had to go to the bathroom. Or, in other words, yet another group of people who'd find a way to make fun of him. The camera had a red light on it, a power indicator, and a single lens that shimmered like a rainbow. There was a rubber bumper around the lens that looked like an eyelid. It struck Peter that even if he wasn't suicidal, a few weeks of this and he would be. It didn't get dark in jail, just dim. That hardly mattered, since there was nothing to do but sleep anyway. Peter lay on the bench, wondering if you lost your hearing if you never had to use it, if the power of speech worked the same way. He remembered learning in one of his social studies classes that in the Old West, when Native Americans were thrown into jail, they sometimes dropped dead. The theory was that someone so used to the freedom of space couldn't handle the confinement. But Peter had another interpretation. When the only company you had was yourself, and when you didn't want to socialize, there was only one way to leave the room. One of the COs had just come through, doing his security sweep, a heavy-booted run past the cells, when Peter heard it.
"I know what you did."
"Holy shit," Peter thought. "I've already started to go crazy."
"Everyone knows."
Peter swung his feet to the cement floor and stared at the camera, but it wasn't giving up any secrets. The voice sounded like wind passing over snow, bleak, a whisper.
"To your right,"
it said, and Peter slowly got to his feet and walked to a corner of the cell.
"Who's there?" he said. "It's about fucking time. I thought you were never gonna stop wailing."
Peter tried to see through the bars, but couldn't.
"You heard me crying?" "Fucking baby," the voice said. "Grow the fuck up."
"Who are you?"
"You can call me Carnivore, like everyone else."
Peter swallowed.
"What did you do?" "Nothing they say I did," Carnivore answered.
"How long?"
"How long what?" "How long till your trial?"
Peter didn't know.
It was the one question he had forgotten to ask Jordan McAfee, probably because he was afraid to hear the answer.
"Mine's next week,"
Carnivore said before Peter could reply. The metal door of the cell felt like ice against his temple.
"How long have you been here?"
Peter asked.
10 months,
Carnivore answered. Peter imagined sitting in this cell for 10 straight months. He thought about all the times he'd count those stupid cinder blocks, all the pisses that the guards would get to watch on their little television set.
"You killed kids, right? You know what happens in this jail to guys who kill kids?"
Peter didn't respond. He was roughly the same age as everyone at Sterling High. It wasn't like he'd gone into a nursery school, and it wasn't like he hadn't had a good reason. He didn't want to talk about this anymore.
"How come you didn't get bail?"
Carnivore scoffed.
"Because they say I raped some waitress and then stabbed her."
Did everyone in this jail think they were innocent? All this time, Peter had spent lying on that bench, convincing himself that he was nothing like anyone else in the Grafton County Jail, and as it turned out, that was a lie. Did he sound like this to Jordan?
"You still there?"
Carnivore asked. Peter lay back down on his bench without saying another word. He turned his face to the wall, and he pretended not to hear as the man next to him tried over and over to make a connection. The first thing that struck Patrick again was how much younger Judge Cormier looked when she wasn't on the bench. She answered the door in jeans and a ponytail, wiping her hands on a dish towel. Josie stood just behind her, her face washed by the same vacant stare he'd seen a dozen times over now in other victims he'd interviewed. Josie was a vital piece in the puzzle, the only one who had seen Peter kill Matthew Royston. But unlike those victims, Josie had a mother who knew the intricacies of the legal system.
"Judge Cormier," he said. "Josie, thanks for letting me come over."
The judge stared at him. "This is a waste of time. Josie doesn't remember anything."
"With all due respect, Judge, it's my job to hear that from Josie herself."
He steeled himself for an argument, but she stepped back to let him inside. Patrick let his eyes roam the foyer, the antique table with a spider plant spilling over its surface, the tasteful landscapes that hung on the walls. So this was how a judge lived. His own place was a pit stop, a haven of laundry and old newspapers and food long past its expiration date, where he'd go for a few hours between his stints at the office. He turned to Josie.
"How's the head?"
"It still hurts,"
she said, so softly that Patrick had to strain to hear her. He turned to the judge again.
"Is there a room where we could go talk for a few minutes?"
She led them into the kitchen, which looked like just the kind of kitchen Patrick sometimes thought about when he imagined where he should have been by now. There were cherry cabinets and lots of sun streaming through the bay window and a bowl of bananas on the counter. He sat down across from Josie, expecting the judge to pull up a chair beside her daughter, but to his surprise she remained standing.
"If you need me," she said, "I'll be upstairs."
Josie looked up, pained.
"Can't you just stay?"
For a moment, Patrick saw something light in the judge's eyes. Want? Regret? But it vanished before he could put a name to it.
"You know I can't," she said gently.
Patrick didn't have any kids of his own, but he was pretty damn sure that if one of his had come this close to dying, he'd have a hard time letting her out of his sight. He didn't know exactly what was going on between the mother and daughter, but he knew better than to get in the middle of it.
"I'm sure Detective Ducharme will make this utterly painless," the judge said.
It was part wish, part warning. Patrick nodded at her. A good cop did whatever he could to protect and serve, but when it was someone you knew who was robbed or threatened or hurt, the stakes changed. You'd make a few more phone calls. You'd shuffle your responsibilities so that one took priority. Patrick had experienced that, to a greater degree, years ago with his friend Nina and her son. He didn't know Josie Cormier personally, but her mother was in the field of law enforcement. Christ, she was at its top level, and for this, her daughter deserved to be treated with kid gloves. He watched Alex walk up the stairs, and then he took a pad and pencil out of his coat pocket.
"So," he said, "how are you doing?"
"Look, you don't have to pretend you care."
"I'm not pretending,"
Patrick said.
"I don't even get why you're here. It's not like anything anyone says to you is going to make those kids less dead."
"That's true,"
Patrick agreed.
"But before we can try Peter Houghton, we need to know exactly what happened. And unfortunately, I wasn't there."
"Unfortunately?"
He looked down at the table.
"I sometimes think it's easier to be the one who's been hurt than the one who couldn't stop it from happening."
"I was there," Josie said, shaken. "I couldn't stop it."
"Hey," Patrick said. "It's not your fault."
She looked up at him then, as if she so badly wished she could believe that, but knew he was wrong. And who was Patrick to tell her otherwise? Every time he envisioned his mad dash to Sterling High, he imagined what would have happened if he'd been at the school when the shooter first arrived. If he'd disarmed the kid before anyone was hurt.
"I don't remember anything about the shooting," Josie said.
Do you remember being in the gym?
Josie shook her head.
How about running there with Matt?
No, I don't even remember getting up and going to school in the first place. It's like a blank spot in my head that I just skip over.
Patrick knew, from talking to the shrinks who'd been assigned to work with the victims, that this was perfectly normal. Amnesia was one way for the mind to protect itself from reliving something that would otherwise break you apart. In a way, he wished he could be as lucky as Josie, that he could make what he'd seen vanish.
What about Peter Houghton? Did you know him?
Everyone knew who he was.
What do you mean?
Josie shrugged.
He got noticed.
Because he was different from everyone else?
Josie thought about this for a moment.
Because he didn't try to fit in.
You were dating Matthew Royston?
Immediately, tears welled in Josie's eyes.
He liked to be called Matt.
Patrick reached for a paper napkin and passed it to Josie.
I'm sorry about what happened to him, Josie.
She ducked her head.
Me too.
He waited for her to wipe her eyes, blow her nose.
Do you know why Peter might have disliked Matt?
People used to make fun of him, Josie said. It wasn't just Matt.
Did you? Patrick thought.
He'd looked at the yearbook confiscated from Peter's room, the circles around certain kids who became victims, and others who did not. There were many reasons for this, from the fact that Peter ran out of time to the truth that hunting down 30 people in a school of 1,000 was more difficult than he had imagined. But of all the targets Peter had marked in the yearbook, only Josie's photo had been crossed out, as if he had changed his mind. Only her face had words printed beneath it, in block letters. Let live.
Did you know him personally? Have any classes or anything with him?
She looked up.
I used to work with him.
Where?
The copy store downtown.
Did you two get along?
Sometimes, Josie said. Not always.
Why not?
He lit a fire there once and I ratted him out. He lost his job after that.
Patrick marked a note down on his pad. Why had Peter made the decision to spare her when he had every reason to hold a grudge?
Before that, Patrick asked, would you say you were friends?
Josie pleated the napkin she'd used to dry her tears into a triangle, a smaller one still.
No, she said. We weren't.
The woman next to Lacey was wearing a checkered flannel shirt, reeked of cigarettes, and was missing most of her teeth. She took one look at Lacey's skirt and blouse.
Your first time here?
She asked. Lacey nodded. They were waiting in a long room, side by side in a row of chairs. In front of their feet ran a red dividing line, and then a second set of chairs. Inmates and visitors sat like mirror images, speaking in shorthand. The woman beside Lacey smiled at her.
You get used to it, she said.
One parent was allowed to visit Peter every 2 weeks, for 1 hour. Lacey had come with a basket full of home-baked muffins and cakes, magazines, books, anything she could think of to help Peter. But the correctional officer who'd signed her in for visitation had confiscated the items. No baked goods, and no reading material, not until it was vetted by the jail staff. A man with a shaved head and sleeves of tattoos up and down his arms headed toward Lacey. She shivered. Was that a swastika inked onto his forehead?
Hi, Mom,
he murmured. And Lacey watched the woman's eyes strip away the tattoos and the bare scalp and the orange jumpsuit to see a little boy catching tadpoles in a mud hole behind their house.
Everyone, Lacey thought, is somebody's son.
She glanced away from their reunion and saw Peter being led into the visitation room. For a moment, her heart caught. He looked too thin, and behind his glasses, his eyes were so empty. But then she tamped down whatever she was feeling and offered him a brilliant smile. She would pretend that it didn't bother her to see her son in a prison jumpsuit, that she hadn't had to sit in the car and fight a panic attack after pulling into the jail lot, that it was perfectly normal to be surrounded by drug dealers and rapists while you asked your son if he was getting enough to eat.
"Peter," she said, folding him into her arms. It took a moment, but he hugged her back. She pressed her face to his neck, the way she used to when he was a baby, and she thought she would devour him. But he didn't smell like her son. For a moment, she let herself entertain the pipe dream that this was all a mistake. Peter's not in jail. This is someone else's unfortunate child. But then she realized what was different. The shampoo and deodorant he had to use here weren't what he'd used at home. This Peter smelled sharper, coarser. Suddenly there was a tap on her shoulder.
"Ma'am," the correctional officer said, "you'll have to let go now."
If only it was that easy, Lacey thought.
They sat down on opposite sides of the red line.
"Are you all right?"
she asked.
"I'm still here."
The way he said it, as if he'd totally expected otherwise by now, made Lacey shudder. She had a feeling he wasn't talking about being let out on bail, and the alternative. The idea of Peter killing himself was something she could not hold in her head. She felt her throat funnel tight, and she found herself doing the one thing she had promised herself she wouldn't do. She started to cry.
"Peter,"
she whispered.
"Why?" "Did the police come to the house?" Peter asked.
Lacey nodded. It seemed as if it had happened so long ago.
"Did they go to my room?"
"They had a warrant."
"They took my things?"
Peter exclaimed, the first emotion she'd seen from him.
"You let them take my things?"
"What were you doing with those things?"
she whispered.
"Those bombs. The guns?"
"You wouldn't understand."
"Then make me, Peter," she said, broken. "Make me understand."
"I haven't been able to make you understand in 17 years, Mom. Why should it be any different now?"
His face twisted.
"I don't even know why you bothered to come."
"To see you?"
"Then look at me," Peter cried. "Why won't you fucking look at me?"
He put his head in his hands, his narrow shoulders rounding with the sound of a sob. It came down to this, Lacey realized. You stared at the stranger in front of you and decided categorically that this was no longer your son. Or you made the decision to find whatever scraps of your child you still could in what he had become. Was that even really a choice, if you were a mother? People could argue that monsters weren't born, they were made. People could criticize her parenting skills, point to moments when Lacey had let Peter down by being too lax or too firm, too removed or too smothering. The town of Sterling would analyze to death what she had done to her son, but what about what she would do for him? It was easy to be proud of the kid who got straight A's and who made the winning basket, a kid the world already adored. But true character showed when you could find something to love in a child everyone else hated. What if the things she had or hadn't done for Peter were the wrong criteria for measurement? Wasn't it just as telling a mark of motherhood to see how, from this awful moment on, she behaved? She reached across the red line until she could embrace Peter. She didn't care if it was allowed or not. The guards could come and pull her off him, but until that happened, Lacey wasn't planning to let her son go. On the surveillance video taken from the cafeteria, students were carrying trays and doing homework and chatting when Peter entered the room holding a handgun. There was a discharge of bullets and a cacophony of screaming. A smoke alarm went off. When everyone started to run, he shot again, and this time, two girls fell down. Other students ran right over them in an effort to get away. When the only people left in the cafeteria were Peter and the victims, he walked through the rows of tables, surveying his handiwork. He passed by the boy he'd shot, who lay in a puddle of blood on top of a book, but he stopped to pick up an iPod that had been left on the table and put the earphones in his ears before turning it off and setting it down again. He turned the page in an open notebook. And then he sat down at one untouched tray and placed the gun on it. He opened a box of Rice Krispies and poured them into a styrofoam bowl. He added the contents of a milk container and ate all the cereal before standing up again, retrieving his pistol, and exiting the cafeteria. It was the most chilling, deliberate thing Patrick had ever seen in his life. He looked down at the bowl of ramen noodles he had cooked himself for dinner and realized he'd lost his appetite. Setting it aside on a stack of old newspapers, he rewound the video and forced himself to watch it again. When the phone rang, he picked it up, still distracted by the sight of Peter on his television screen.
"Yeah."
"Well, hello to you, too," Nina Frost said. He melted when he heard her voice. Old habits died hard.
"Sorry, I'm just in the middle of something."
"I can imagine. It's all over the news. How you holding up?"
"Oh, you know," he said,
when what he really meant was that he was not sleeping at night, that he saw the faces of the dead whenever he closed his eyes, that his mouth was full of questions he was certain he'd forgotten to ask. "Patrick," she said, because she was his oldest friend, and because she knew him better than anyone, including himself.
"Don't blame yourself."
He bent his head.
"It happened in my town. How can't I?"
"If you had a video phone, I'd be able to tell you if you're wearing your hair shirt or your cape and boots," Nina said.
"It's not funny."
"No, it's not," she agreed. "But you must know it's a slam dunk at trial. You have, what, 1,000 witnesses?"
"Something like that."
Nina grew quiet. Patrick didn't have to explain to her, a woman who'd lived with regret as a constant companion, that convicting Peter Houghton wasn't enough. For Patrick to lay this to rest, he'd have to understand why Peter had done this in the first place, so that he could keep it from happening again. From an FBI investigatory report published by special agents in charge of examining school shootings around the globe. Among school shooters, we have seen a similarity of family dynamics. Often the shooter will have a turbulent relationship with his parents or will have parents who accept pathological behavior. There is a lack of intimacy within the family. There are no limits for television or computer use imposed on the shooter, and sometimes there is access to weapons. Within the school environment, we found a tendency toward detachment from the learning process on the part of the shooter. The school itself tended to tolerate disrespectful behavior, exhibited inequitable discipline, and an inflexible culture, with certain students enjoying prestige given to them by teachers and staff. Shooters are more likely to have access to violent movies, television, and video games, to use drugs and alcohol, to have a peer group that exists outside of school and supports their behavior. In addition, prior to a violent act, there is evidence of leakage, a clue that something is coming. These hints might take the form of poems, writings, drawings, internet posts, or threats made in person or in absentia. In spite of the commonalities described within, we caution the use of this report to create a checklist that might predict future school shooters. In the hands of the media, this might result in labeling many nonviolent students as potentially lethal. In fact, a great many adolescents who will never commit violent acts will show some of the traits on the list.